welcome to Star Wars Sleepover, a laid-back exploration of a captivating and sometimes ridiculous galaxy far, far away. I'm Yurupa Tokani, and I'm here with my co-host for our last episode of the season.
Crazy that we've hit the end already. I'm Loya Rowan, and for this last episode, we are going to be discussing the enchanting novelization of The Last Jedi by Jason Fry. It is always a pleasure to talk about The Last Jedi, so let's do this.
It is time now for Cantina Corner. Every episode, Loya and I each choose a Star Wars-themed cocktail to enjoy during our sleepover. And this week, we actually both chose a Rey-themed cocktail. I chose the same one as her, and she got to the outline first to put the link there, so I chose a different one. But I ended up going with Rey's Dark Side from Main Cocktails. And Loya, I think you had made a cocktail from this website previously. This one is, according to the recipe, 1.5 ounces Maker's Mark bourbon, 1 ounce pomegranate juice, 0.5 ounces lemon juice, and ginger beer.
Oh.
Of course. It is slightly modified, so mine is actually 1.5 ounces Jameson, pomegranate juice, lemon juice, and Q, not affiliated with QAnon, Q ginger ale.
Nice. That sounds delicious.
So I am going to go ahead and try it.
I'm actually shocked that I haven't noticed, like, I was on this website. I made the Kessel Run, I think, from this one, right?
I think so.
I'm looking.
So, it is very good. It's very tart because it's pomegranate and lemon juice, but I feel like it goes really well with the whiskey, and the ginger beer also mixes nicely with it all, so I would definitely recommend it.
Yeah, I was wrong. It was the Cloud City Aviation. That was like two episodes ago, and I totally overlooked Rey's Dark Side, which sounds incredible.
Okay, so what did you make, Loya?
So, the one I made is from Chilled Magazine, and it is a Reytini, and I also modified it, which is funny because it looks like it's courtesy of Partida Tequila. I did not use tequila because we didn't have white tequila. We only had Jose Cuervo, and I didn't feel like using it, so I used mezcal instead. So, it is mezcal in my case, fresh squeezed lime juice, agave nectar, and champagne. And then you build all the ingredients. Build.
build them.
Mix.
By hand.
Yeah. Yeah. You mix them all except the champagne. Add ice, shake. Wow. I would rewrite these instructions. Okay. So you throw ice into a shaker, add the ingredients, strain into martini glass, and then top with champagne and garnish with a long lime twist. As everyone knows, I don't use martini glasses because I'm nervous about spilling them, so it's just in a plain glass. But I will give this a shot. Wow. I never would have thought of mixing mezcal and champagne, or even tequila and champagne. It's very good. It is very good.
Good to know. I'll definitely have to try that one because it sounded very intriguing.
Yeah, I'm surprised.
Well, cheers to Rey, I guess, and The Last Jedi, and our last episode of season two.
Yeah. Yes, cheers. And it's now time for the Mouse Droid segment, where we discuss other ways we've been interacting with Star Wars and any housekeeping items we may have.
So I have a random thing to discuss, which is that a couple of weeks ago, my husband texted me a picture of a box with random Star Wars merchandise in it. And he was like, "Do you want any of this?" And I was like, "I don't know, possibly." I still don't know where it came from. I have the box right here next to me, and I'm going to do an inventory of it shortly. But So my husband's dad is a general contractor. He has what he calls his shop, which is like where he stores a lot of his equipment, but he also just collects random things. Mm-hmm. And he used to go to auctions a lot and would just like buy anything that looked interesting or that he thought he might be able to sell at some point, even though in reality it just sits there. And I know he's not going to auctions now. I don't know if this is like someone he knows, someone he was doing a job for. Like, I literally don't know the origins of this box, but
you have it now.
I have it now. I told my husband, like, yes, just take it. And then once I have it in my possession, I will go through it and see if any of it is of interest. So there were a couple of items that I could see in the photo. So this is a reason that I asked for it. And I feel like, listeners, when I get to those items, you will know what it was that caused me to want to have this box in my possession. But I'm just gonna go item by item. So there is a child's backpack.
That has
Darth Vader on it. It is very child size, and apparently I have not opened it, but my husband did, and he says it has child size elbow and knee pads in it. There is a Star Wars The Legacy Collection Count Dooku holographic transmission figure. So it is literally an action figure of Count Dooku, but as a hologram.
Why did they make this? That is my only question.
I don't know. I have that question as well. And now that I'm looking at it more closely, I also realize that, like, I guess it's supposed to be like part of his tunic or something, but he looks like he has like a glittery blue skirt on. So that's interesting.
Wow. And he's blue. I mean, like, in the picture you sent
me. He is blue.
He's entirely blue.
He is entirely blue. And apparently this is from 2008.
Wow.
So, that's interesting.
That is.
This is also, I mean, this is all interesting, let's be real. But I also have a plastic Chewbacca head that then opens up to become like a Polly Pocket playset of Endor.
Oh my gosh.
And it has like a backdrop with the AT-ST and Ewoks and like a treehouse, but there's no figures. It's just Chewbacca's head with the scene, but no figures. This is from 1995.
Wow, that's really sad there aren't figures. Otherwise, this sounds incredible. I was a sucker for Polly Pocket.
Me too. I love Polly Pocket. Then I also have Darth Maul on his speeder. And I don't know what this is from. It has one wheel. But, like, it's only intended to have one wheel.
Okay, I was like, it's missing the other
one. I'm not sure what's going on with that. It was just loose in the box. It doesn't have a package. There's also a Tusken Raider. It's, Attack of the Clones Tusken Raider with Massif. It's an opened package. I also have Star Wars Episode 1 branded Simon.
Wait, what?
Yeah, like the game Simon.
Simon Says.
No, it's like an electronic game where you have to repeat the pattern.
Yeah.
It's that, but Star Wars Episode 1 branded.
So, what is...
Is that just a detail?
Yeah, I'm like, so, is it just the packaging, or like...
The central screen is... like the Naboo Starfighters.
Okay.
And then they have different color, like, they have like a different color, like, glow around them. So whatever one like lights up is the one you have to press. And then, like, in the center of the Simon buttons are ships from episode one.
Wow.
I don't know if this works.
I know, I'm like, you need to put batteries in it right
Yeah, I don't know. I'm sure if the batteries are in here, they are definitely dead. I have not tried to put new batteries in it yet.
I need an update on this, like, before we get to season three.
So then I have Fan's Choice Sand Trooper.
What does that mean?
Which is from 2007.
Why are these all so late? Because I'm just like, well, I guess, when did the last prequel come out?
2005.
Right, yeah, because I saw it in Poland. So why are, yeah, that's interesting timing for all this.
So then, now we get to my true items of interest, which are Star Wars Episode 1 Queen Amidala Collection dolls. I have both Hidden Majesty Queen Amidala and Ultimate Hair Queen Amidala.
Wow. The names of these are very similar to the names of my, like, Grand Champion horses I used to own.
So
that's disturbing a little.
These are, like, insane. And I had looked these up to see if they were worth money. They're definitely not. Like, you can easily purchase them on eBay for, like, $30. However,
I mean, $30 is a lot.
Well, so they have price tags on them from Toys R Us.
I will not dare. And
one of them was originally purchased, so $24.99, and the other one was, well, that's not true. So they were originally marked $19.99 and $24.99. However, they both have a sticker on them that says new lower price, and Ultimate Hair Queen Amidala was $14.98, and then sadly Hidden Majesty Queen Amidala was $5.
Yeah. So I mean, selling them for $30, that is quite a profit.
So Ultimate Hair Queen Amidala, like, you can style her hair.
I can't even handle this.
She has, like, different headpieces, and then she has this, like, fabric that you can wrap her hair around.
What?
To create different hairstyles. However, it is hilarious because if you look at the box, and all, I mean, if you just look at the outfit she's wearing, it is an outfit that Sabe wears.
Oh, no. But wait, what? How does the fabric work? Like,
so
what hairstyles?
So it's like, it's kind of like a loop, and you put the hair through it and then just, like, wrap it.
To create, I see. Like,
like, kind of similar to the hairstyle in, like, the very famous red dress.
Mm-hmm. Right.
But, yeah, like, 100%. It's the other black and red dress.
The one I like.
That Sabe wears. Yeah. And the picture on the box is of Sabe. And the caption is, under the brave leadership of Queen Amidala, the Gunkins and people of Naboo joined forces to fight the invasion of their planet.
Well, technically, I mean, Queen Amidala was kind of a persona. No. That's just sloppy toy making.
I was just telling Loya my allergies are so bad, and, like, now I'm touching all these, like, dusty things in this box, so if that affects my voice, just know. That's why.
It's allergies.
Yeah. So then, Hidden Majesty Queen Amidala is bizarre. So, it's the doll itself has, like, the Queen Amidala makeup, the white makeup, mm-hmm. with the two red dots on the cheeks and the red lipstick. However, it comes with an additional head.
Oh my god, no way, that was an additional head?
Yes, that is, like, has a hood, like, the handmaiden's orange outfit, like the hood for that, and, like, literally what you do apparently to, you know, accomplish the Hidden Majesty aspect of this is put the hood with the extra face in it over the doll's head.
Over?
Yes.
What? Okay, so when you sent me those pictures, I initially, like, it looked like a head that was, like, suspended next to the doll. And I thought it was, like, a head you could, like, switch out. And then I realized, like, oh, no, it's probably another doll. It is not another doll, then.
It is not another doll.
It's a head. Like, that head is bigger than the other head.
I think it's really just a face. Like, I don't think it's a full head.
Wow. That is so creepy. That's...
Yeah.
Huh. And that's the one that was $5.
Yes.
That makes a lot of sense.
I mean, I love these. They're really not in good shape. Like, the boxes are very beat up. So I almost want to take them out of the boxes, but I am kind of obsessed with them.
Yeah.
I am, however, missing the third doll, which is Royal Elegance Queen Amidala, which is, like, the iconic dress. I do not have that one, unfortunately.
I can't even handle these names. Like, it's just Grand Champions to me. Hidden Majesty.
I also got in this box the Attack of the Clones Visual Dictionary.
Ooh.
Which I really want to read. And then yes. I saw these and I was like, what is this? So I don't even know how to describe these. You're definitely going to have to put like a photo of these yes. on the website. It's like a giant, like it almost is like a floppy disk.
What?
It's hard plastic. It's giant. It's like the size of a record.
Okay.
And just like, what is this? So I have what is not even branded as A New Hope. It's branded as Star Wars.
Okay.
Empire Strikes Back. And I actually have two copies of Return of the Jedi from like the 80s. So they're definitely the original versions. And it is labeled as Capacitance Electronic Disk System. I had to look this up because I have never heard of this before in my life.
No.
Apparently, for a very short time in the 80s, they were like producing these discs that were a form of video, like home video, but they are basically like records. Like they're played with a needle.
Wait, can you buy something that would play these?
I think, yeah, but I don't know how easy it is to...
And are they the full movie, then?
Yes.
Wow.
But it is, like, the most obscure form of media possible. Like, literally had no idea that this even was a thing.
No.
Ever. And they just are so weird looking. So now I learned about that. I don't think I'm ever going to be able to play these, but...
Are they worth anything? Because I feel like...
No.
Oh.
We looked those up, too, and they were like... Yeah.
I love how I'm always convinced, like, well, maybe it's worth something. That is a sheer product of my grandparents who grew up in the Depression. They saved everything. Because it could be worth something. You never know.
So, I don't think anything that's in that box is, like, really worth anything. It's worth it to me just to have seen all of these bizarre and obscure Star Wars merchandise products. And, like, I truly will cherish those Queen Amidala dolls.
Yes, I agree. I definitely want to see, like, when I come visit, I want to see the one, the Hidden Majesty one, closer.
Sorry, I'm sure you can hear my dog in the background. I don't think there's anything I can do about it, so.
She's excited about the Star Wars stuff,
yeah,
too.
Of course.
Well, that was a delight. I did not think when you had mentioned, like, you had something for the Mouse Droid segment, I was imagining something else entirely, and that was exceeding my expectations entirely. Wow.
Good, yeah. I got all this stuff a couple of days ago, but I wanted to wait for recording for the reveal of everything that was in the box.
I'm just really fascinated, like, because yeah, there were things that, like, I didn't know what that Chewy head was, and it's a Polly Pocket Chewy. I wonder if you could find the figures for cheap, because that would be really adorable.
Yeah,
play with that with, like, kids, you know.
I'm trying to think. I like now I feel like I almost possibly remember one of my friend's brothers having something like that. I'll have to ask her. Because he had a ton of like Star Wars action figures, and we still like talk about this to this day, and I may have talked about it on the podcast before, but she dropped her brother's Darth Vader down into my dad's armchair because I like made her bring them to my house at one point, and she was like freaking out because she thought her brother was gonna kill her, and we like had to wait for my dad to come home from work so that he could try and get it out of the chair, and it was just like highly stressful and dramatic.
I am pretty sure you have not talked about that because I would remember that story. Wow. Well, I'll ask you later which friend that is. I feel like I maybe know, but I'm very curious.
Yeah. I'm sure you know.
Yeah. Maybe. Now I'm second guessing myself. It's fine. This is irrelevant to our conversation. And now we will get started with The Last Jedi. So, some background on this novel. It was obviously drafted with input from Rian Johnson. It includes some deleted scenes, including the scene which we've talked about in a previous episode about Rose biting Hux, which I was excited to see. And then I want to clarify that I read the expanded edition. I think that's the more common one out there. And I think you did too, Europa, right?
I don't know if there's a not expanded edition, because I feel like every time they do a novelization, it's always the expanded edition. I don't know if that just means it's expanded from the movie, but yes, I did read the expanded edition as well.
Perfect. And yeah, I have a hard copy of it from the library. And so the page numbers I will be referencing are from the hardcover version.
Yeah, as usual, we do not have the same version. I have the Kindle version, and in looking at your references, Loya, they're definitely not the same as mine. So
that makes sense.
If I reference a page number, it's the Kindle version, which is probably confusing. But again, is it really critical that you know the page number? Probably not.
I feel like this is just like a carryover from college, and I'm like, I have to reference the page number. I mean, if you are inspired, good for you. If you're not, we get it.
Exactly.
I'm just like, have I ever listened to a podcast and like flipped open to that page? No. So. All right. So in looking this up, I found a fandom entry that clarified some several differences between the novel and the film, and then scenes that don't appear in the final film, including the deleted scene we referenced with Hux and Rose. And so I will just provide like brief outlines about the ones that are kind of different, and then we're going to go into like more detail with the main segment of the pod. So obviously the first one is the dream that Luke has about how his life could have been if he hadn't rescued Leia. I will talk about that later. I'm just going to table that. The novel includes a funeral for Han Solo, and we'll talk about that too. There's more dialogue between the commander on... What is the commander? Oh, the Fulminatrix. Between Kanady and Sude Baskus. There's a scene about, like, kind of gives insight to Chewie when he's fixing modifications made to the Millennium Falcon. There's a really weird scene that we'll talk about when Luke tells Rey about the caretakers being raided and pillaged, or plundered, I guess. That was weird. This is kind of like... We're gonna get into more like
just a rundown of all of the expanded elements of the expanded edition,
and some of them were fine. Like there as well, and we're going to talk about most of these as they come up with the different characters. So this is kind of just like a large top-down view. So there's also a scene where Finn, Rose, and DJ are, well, Finn's recognized by a stormtrooper when they're posing as officers. And then there's some insight into Luke, and when he's force projecting during the Battle of Crait, there's a comment where he hears a voice that says, "Let go, Luke." That's not in the movie. And then the novel concludes with Leia and Chewie mourning the deaths of everyone they had lost. And that was also not in the film. And then we will link to these on our websites. 7 Reasons Why The Last Jedi Novelization is Essential. And then all the things that Star Wars The Last Jedi Novelization contributed to the understanding of The Last Jedi. So what was your overall impression, Europa?
I liked it. I feel like it was not as expanded as I hoped it would be, I guess. So I don't have a lot of experience with the novelizations. I don't necessarily read them as a rule. I really only sought them out after Rise of Skywalker because I just struggled with that movie. And yep. I thought that reading the novel would maybe help to fill in some gaps and to actually expand upon it and just help me process it more. And that one did. I recommend reading Rise of Skywalker novelization because I think Rae Carson does an excellent job with it and really does flesh things out and make connections that I think need to be made. And I give her a lot of credit for what she was able to do with that novelization. Mm-hmm. So I don't know if I was maybe expecting more from this one for that reason, but I kind of just wanted to go back and watch the movie. The movie is so good, and I don't feel like it needs a novelization necessarily to expound upon it, I guess.
Interesting. That's very interesting, because I was surprised at how much, like, reading the novel, like, it did make me want to go back and watch the movie. But I was surprised at how much it added, especially in regards to, like, Rose and Finn, maybe, as we'll talk about. So I really liked it. I also have not read many novelizations at all. At all.
I would be interested in reading more of them, but I know some of the early ones, for the original trilogy, if I recall correctly, like, I think the A New Hope one was written, like, possibly before the other two movies were written, and then there's Slinkers of the Mind's Eye, which I would love to read, because it just deviates completely from, like, George Lucas's plan, I think, for the other movies, and, like, it just has things that were rendered completely invalid by the other two movies, and, like, there's, like, a heavily implied romance between Luke and Leia.
Oh, dear God.
I forget, like, I think, if I'm remembering correctly, I think it sets it up so that, like, Anakin Skywalker is a different person, like, is not Darth Vader, Darth Vader is not Luke's father, like, it's just completely divergent from what actually happens. And then I know the prequels have novelizations. I've heard that Revenge of the Sith's novelization is, like, really good, and I would love to read that one because I just have heard so much about it, and I already like that movie, but I've heard that it does actually lend it a lot more depth. So I would be interested to read more of them for sure. But again, it's just not, like, something that I've done up to this point.
I just added those two books for next season possible topics, or the season after that. So that's exciting. I had no context for any of that. I don't think I've ever read a novelization of a movie in anything, like, ever.
So, they also used to come out before the movie, too, which is crazy. What? So, yeah. Like, the magazine would be published and just, like, reveal the whole plot of the movie. And more recently, like, I assume this one, and I know Rise of Skywalker, like, wasn't released until after the movie.
Yeah. Well, that makes way more sense. I was like, why would you do that? Like, I guess for people who don't mind spoilers, maybe?
Yeah, I guess.
Yeah. I can't imagine reading a book before going to see... Well, I shouldn't say that. Considering the amount of adaptations of movies from books, obviously I've read the book before seeing the movie, but it just seems weird when the plot of the movie comes first and then they novelize? I don't know. They write a novel about it. I also wanted to note that my initial impression was not that I loved it. It was I hated it because I read the first line, which says Luke Skywalker stood in the cooling sands in Tatooine, his wife by his side. It was pretty late at night. I closed the book and I was like, nope, I'm not going to do this. I was like this close to texting you, Europa, and being like, Luke has a wife, and just being like very reactive and judgmental. And then I completed the prologue and I was like, oh, okay. It's a dream. Hated it.
Yeah, I do remember hearing about that when this book was first published, and I think they maybe even like released that first chapter before the book. And it was very controversial.
Yeah.
And I feel like some of that stems from the whole, like, people that were really into the old EU, mm-hmm. where Luke did have a wife. Yep. And obviously that's not where The Last Jedi went. So I don't know. I don't know if that was hard to deal with for some people, that they were like, oh, let's go back to this idea, and then no, you know, it's not actually happening. But I didn't mind that. I definitely think it was a hook for the beginning of the book, and I thought it made sense in the context of the theme going on with Luke of
right.
his questioning his choices and what impact he actually had on the galaxy.
There was a part where Cammy, his like wife in the dream, was just like, you have that look where you're like looking away and being like, oh, what could have been? It makes me feel like you don't like treasure our life together. And I'm like, that seems like a red flag to me.
Well, I mean, they were like still living under the Empire and, yeah. you know, like Leia had been executed and there was no rebellion. And they were just like, this is how it is. Like the Hutts are still in charge of Tatooine. Like, we just have to go about our business and produce what we have to produce and just, like...
See? That's what I mean by, like, the last temptation not being that tempting. Like, that seems like a hard pass to me.
So, I did want to point out, too, Cammy is actually from a deleted scene of A New Hope, where they had this, like, he and his friends had this female friend named Cammy, and I think they, like, go, I don't know, somewhere on Tatooine and have a conversation with her, but, yeah, she was cut from the movie.
That makes way more sense, because, like, there's, like, these allusions to them being friends, and I was like, what is this from? Sorry. Darth Brooks is pouring me more champagne. I was like, this champagne is going to go flat. I cannot take this bottle
on yeah. the... That's the problem.
On the river with me.
Sparkling wine.
Yeah. If I start getting loopy later, it's because champagne goes straight to my head.
I mean, if I'm being honest, I honestly can't imagine Luke being in a relationship.
No! Well, so I mentioned this to Darth Brooks, and he had, again, we've talked about him reading the EU, and he's like, oh, are they going to bring in, what was her name?
Mara Jade.
Yeah.
Again, like, Mara I Jade. Also just want to point out here, I have read, I think, exactly one old EU book, which we definitely have to cover on this podcast at some point.
Yes.
I have not read any books that involve Mara Jade. So I have limited, I have knowledge of Mara Jade, but not extensive knowledge.
Yeah, Darth Brooks said her name, and I was like, okay, whatever. No, her name's Cammy. And I hate it. And then once I got past the prologue, I was like, okay, we're good. Although, and we will talk about this, there is a definite lack of Raylo in this book. I'm going to make the case that Jason Fry is not a Raylo person.
That's interesting to me, and I can expound upon it later, but I don't know if I agree with that completely.
Oh my gosh, this is great. We very rarely, like, strongly disagree on this pod, so I'm looking forward to you and I talking about this in a very awkward way that I just phrased it. All right. We've talked about the way I structure some of our outlines being a little counterintuitive. Like, you know, I've said before, I should go in order or follow the timeline. But because we've talked so much about The Last Jedi and we know the plot so well, I decided to structure this in terms of character. And so this is going to kind of jump all over the place, but it is going to be themed by character. And I grouped them by resistance as in the First Order and then other, which just ended up being one person. We're going to start with Leia, obviously, because she's amazing. And I really enjoyed the continuation of, like, what we learned from other novels. So there are clear references in The Last Jedi novelization to Leia, Princess of Alderaan. And one of them is on page 220, where Leia fixed her with a look Holdo knew too well. She'd seen on Alderaan during the pathfinding expeditions of their youth and the apprentice legislature on Coruscant, etc., etc. And I was like, ugh. Just those, the fact that, like, obviously Jason Fry knows of the other books, references them. Like, I really like that aspect of Disney Lucasfilm's, like, canonization process for Star Wars. That might make me a minority. But the consistency, right? Like, it's nice.
It does seem, I mean, they all obviously have to have communications with the story group and each other, but it does seem like they're all very supportive of each other, which is very nice.
I really like it. And then early on in the book, as we talked about, there's the memorial service for Han Solo. God, that was devastating.
Yeah, that's, I do wish that they could have had that in the movie. I feel like
Carrie Fisher Harrison would Ford was
probably
scene.
Like, I came back once, but then he came back again, so he definitely could have just laid there and been a corpse.
Yeah, exactly.
Man, or they didn't even have to show him. They could have just, you know, done a quick scene indicating that there was a funeral.
Yeah, and Carrie Fisher would have been, like, so on top of that. Like, man. Yeah, it felt like a very familiar, like, again, just accompanying Leia on this journey. And we've talked about that with, like, our discussion on Leia, Princess of Alderaan, like, how hard her life is. And, like, this book just, like, really makes that clear.
Yeah, and then there are mentions even from Rey where she was like, I don't want to go to Leia with anything that's going on with me because I'm just going to add to her grief, and, like, I can't do that to her. And then it also just made me annoyed at Poe. I think it was specifically when I was reading the scene where she, like, wakes up from her coma and Poe is there and she's just pointing her blaster at him.
Yeah.
And I was just like, God, like, Poe is just, like, such a pain in Leia's like,
yep.
Like, if really she has to deal with Poe too, like, come on.
I know. And despite, like, Poe having these, like, insights, brief insights into Leia, he really doesn't understand. He just doesn't. It's frustrating. And this novel does simultaneously a really good job of humanizing him and also just not. So I feel like I'm interested because maybe that was something we could have mentioned again in the Mouse Droid segment, is we were featured in Into a Larger World, and part of that, is it an issue of the scene? There was this really compelling essay by Amanda M. She draws attention to, like, Poe being humanized in different, like, aspects of the EU and, like, the different novels. And it was really cool, in, like, right before reading this, because it made me more excited for Poe. But Poe in regards to Leia is still just very frustrating.
Yeah, I was very intrigued by that article because I struggle with Poe a lot.
Yep.
And I was like, oh, like, maybe I should read some of these other things because it sounds like it might help me understand him better as a character. But then she did also mention that basically all of that just got retconned in the novel that was leading up to Rise of Skywalker. So that's disappointing. But yeah, I feel like the Last Jedi novelization definitely kind of helps you to get into Poe's head more and to understand what's going on with him internally, but it doesn't necessarily allow me to justify his behavior.
Yes. Yep. And he doesn't, yeah, in regards to Leia specifically, because we are talking about Leia, it doesn't add much there. Like, you get more of a sense that Poe has mad respect for Leia, but that is actually pretty clear in the movie as well. So,
right, he has respect for her, but he still just thinks that he knows better.
Yep. 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 Very frustrating.
And then she does trust him, and
inexplicably.
Yeah, and, like, I guess it works out, but, yeah, I... She does also slap him in the face at one point.
Yeah.
I really can't fault her for.
Nope. Nope. I would be slapping in the face and then just like, yeah. I wanted her to do more. And I wanted Holdo to do more. And just, yeah, like maybe. As we talked about in this, I tend to go to the extremes. And so he would be dead to me and I would relegate him to janitor duty and that'd be it. So yeah,
I mean, possibly. She did demote him
further, but I do understand he's a good pilot, so I should be more forgiving and understanding. And then getting back to Leia, so the novel makes frequent references throughout that, like references to her grief and like how hard it was for her to like be this leader. And there's a reference early on about her, like someone calling it a cult of personality, and she is horrified by that, which I thought was very interesting, and also just like ties in with everything we know about Leia, right? That's not the role she really wanted, and that's not how she envisions herself. And then in addition to that, it also provides like some very serious backstory in regards to like Leia interacting with the Force, which I appreciated. That felt good in a way that the brief scene we see in The Rise of Skywalker did not, right? Like, this is a serious engagement with, like, Leia talking about how she's drawn the Force her entire life, and Luke pointed that out to her, and it wasn't just, like, these moments that we see in the films, but it's, like, when she's talking to people, when she's persuading people, it's this kind of really cool use of the Force. It's almost like a I don't know how to describe it, like a social lubricant, I guess. She's persuasive because she's drawing on the Force,
right?
Like, be successful in the Senate because she's drawing on the Force.
Yeah, it's almost like it allows her to have intuition and to know how to respond in a persuasive way.
Yes. I feel like this is, like, the perfect opportunity to talk about Mass Effect, right? It's, like, she gets extra options when she's making a dialogue choice.
I agree. I really like how her connection with the Force is described in this, because it's in line with who we know Leia to be.
Yeah.
It's not something that we've never seen her do. Like, you know, Leia was a diplomat, and she is a leader, and that's, you know, where her skills are and what she sees as being her calling. So it is nice to see the Force explained as leading her in those actions versus like traditional things that you would associate with the Force and being a Jedi. But yeah, emphasizing that she still is Force sensitive and, again, has always felt the Force and has always drawn on it, just in her own way that is different from the way that Luke does.
Yeah. It would have been really cool to kind of, like, extrapolate that towards Padme, right? Because Leia is very much her mother's daughter, despite Padme dying in childbirth. And so it would have been cool to kind of, like, explore that further. But I do feel like if that were the case for Padme, the Jedi Council would have been more aware of it. Maybe not. But it would have been cool to kind of explore the Force more for, like, more in that respect with the earlier movies as well. And then another thing we talked about briefly before is when we were, I think it was our Ben Solo episode, we talked about Leia and her anxiety in terms of Ben and how she felt the shadow in him even before she gave birth. And Luke had reassured her that this was normal. The brighter the light, the darker the shadow. And she kind of, in the novel, skips ahead, like, has these, like, vignettes, which always reminds me of vinaigrettes. That one time I said it to you. Like, every single time I say vignettes and I'm talking to you, I'm like, oh, yeah, that one time I said vinaigrettes to Europa. That was in college at this point, more than 10 years ago. But, it was these brief, like, depictions of all these moments, like, as Ben was growing up and Leia's concern for him and how she was so worried for him. And that kind of overview was just so sad. Like, Leia's chapters, I loved it because we love Leia, but at the same time, like, they were hard. They were very sad. All right. And then from Leia, we're going to go to Luke. And I will say Luke was, along with, like, Finn and Rose, was one of the characters I felt like really was, my understanding was enhanced by the novelization. Like, I liked the depiction of Luke in the novel.
In part because I agree.
Yeah, I like Grumpy Luke. Like, he's so much better when he's world-weary and bitter. First thing I'm going to mention is the fact that novelization makes it very clear, as we've talked about, that Luke's X-Wing is not salvageable. Just going to lay that, that sit for a second.
Been underwater for numerous years, and also he has used part of one of the wings as a door, so...
Yeah.
Really not sure how it would be flyable in any way.
Yep. He sabotaged it. And Rey looks down and categorizes it based on her, like, experience as a scavenger and says, nope, that's not salvageable. And then it rises from the dead. And the rise
is that
Skywalker.
Where, like, she's like, nope, like, zero portions for that?
Yep. I loved that. I should have mentioned that in the outline because, like, that is something that kind of, like, Rey has a sense of humor more in this. And some of that shows through when she's talking to Luke. Although possibly it's just because I'm finding it funny.
I did also really enjoy their additional dialogue. I wish we had gotten more of it.
Yes! And so there's, like, I love the dialogue in the movie where, especially, like, the scene where he's saying, where are you from? And she's like, nowhere. And he's like, no, seriously, where are you from? And she's like, Jakku. Okay, that is nowhere. I love Mark Hamill's delivery in that. Like, it just makes me, like, it warms my heart. And so I was sad because, like, if this had been in the movie, I would have enjoyed Mark Hamill saying these lines so much. So one of them that I had to, like, quote. Oh, yeah, because I'm Bitter Luke. I can do this. All right. I will be Bitter Luke in this reading.
All right. Okay. Is there dialogue I need?
No, it's just me.
All right.
Wait. We should. Like, we could make this a dialogue portion. I did have to write younglings with a smiley face in the outline because younglings.
Have you ever seen that meme where it's like I saw the Obi-Wan quote where he's like, I saw Anakin killing younglings, but, like, you know, the beer Yingling.
Yeah. Yes.
It's like I saw Anakin killing Yinglings. It's just like a bunch of bottles of beer.
Oh my god. I think we drank that at Universal when we went down there because I never had it. And, like, it was our morning beer when that guy came up to us.
personally.
It was when the guy came up and was just like, I had my morning beer at 5 o'clock. And I said, I gotta go to work.
Yes, I distinctly remember you telling me about that and just being like horrified. And I was like, that would never happen at
Disney. No, it would not happen at Disney. Garth Brooks and I may be universal people at heart. It was like 10 o'clock in the morning. Good times. Anyway,
right, I found it.
All right. Let's start with the resistance, Emmy, and you can be Rey. Because this is pretty good dialogue.
I will not do a British accent. So.
I tried and failed, so I understand.
The resistance sent me, Rey said.
They sent you? What's special about you? Jedi lineage? Royalty?
Rey was none of those things, and after a moment's consideration, Luke seemed to sense that.
An orphan, he said wearily. This is my nightmare. 1,000 wannabe younglings showing up at my doorstep, hoping they're the chosen whoever's, wanting to know how to lift rocks. Where are you from? Luke said.
Nowhere, Rey said, recalling endless days of heat and sand.
No one's from nowhere.
Shaku.
Luke raised an eyebrow. All right, that's pretty much nowhere. Why are you here, Rey from nowhere?
All right, I think, yeah.
I feel like I was maybe channeling Mark Hamill's crankiness a little.
Yeah.
I love how I wrote in this outline, it makes it very explicit that Luke wasn't intending to start a school for Jedi, who's a reluctant teacher at best, and then could not find any support for that. There was something on page 146 on my book, I think, where... There are also pictures of mine. Did you get the pictures of the Kindle version?
Oh, no, I didn't get pictures.
Oh, yeah, I got, like, screenshots. You know, like, the glossy...
Yes.
Yeah.
Because I did get those in the Rise of Skywalker novelization, which I have a print copy of.
Yes. So, in that, on that page 146 of mine, he's talking about, like, in the movie, he's like, I became a legend. And then, for many years, there was balance. I took no Padawans and no darkness rose. So it kind of like suggests that he was like very, he wanted things to kind of remain as they were. But then I saw Ben, my nephew, with that mighty Skywalker blood. In my hubris, I thought I could train him. I could pass on my strengths. I might not be the last Jedi. I took him and a dozen students and began a training temple. And by the time I realized I was no match for the darkness rising in him, it was too late.
Well, from... the Rise of Kylo Ren comic, it kind of seems like Luke spent a lot of time traveling around and going to all the ancient Jedi temples and just, like, gathering knowledge and artifacts.
Yeah.
So I think he was focused on that, and then I guess it's implied through both this and that because he did recognize that Ben, he needed help. To be trained, he was like, alright, and then... I don't know if he decided that he wanted to train more Jedi or if other people just, like, found out about it. And then he was like, all right, well, I guess I'll train these people too.
Yeah, it's actually not clear there. You're right. So I'm thinking, like, all the people who, like, attended the training program with Ben, he would have had to find them.
Right.
Which, I mean, like, maybe he was putting up flyers. Is your child force sensitive? Do they need a summer camp? Contact Luke. So maybe, or maybe they were referred, I guess. I'm trying to think, like, who is all out there, right? Maybe that's Grogu's job. recruiting children. But I guess, like, there are enough people at the end that, like, you know, they could have been making, it's not that big of a congregation.
Oh wow, like, that's such a good point though, because now I like the gears are turning and I'm like, wait, based on like what we've just discussed, yes, but now that Grogu is in the mix,
yeah,
that was much earlier.
Yeah,
because Ben was only like a small child at that point.
Yep, exactly.
And what do they, I think they say in, I don't know if it's in Rise of Kylo Ren or something else, but, like, he basically goes to train with Luke when he's 10.
Yeah, so Grogu would probably
be prior to that.
Yeah. though possibly still a child.
Right.
He could have been part of that congregation. I like how I'm referring to the congregation. That parish. Pretty sure that's not the Jedi preferred term for the grouping, but a parliament
cohort.
Oh my gosh, a cohort of Jedi. I love it. I mean, especially with like the way Luke's doing it, it is a cohort. That makes a lot of sense. So yeah, I would like to know how that came about. Because it's not like he was hunting them down. I mean, maybe he was. I guess we don't know.
Maybe that was Grogu's job. I don't know.
Yeah. Or someone else. Like, I'm thinking Ahsoka's still around, right? No. Yes.
Yeah, Ahsoka's still around.
Yeah. So maybe that's her job? Or, like, wherever Ezra comes back in?
I know people really want to see Ahsoka interact with Luke. Like, that is a common...
I do not want to see that, actually. I don't know why. I don't know why. Yeah, I'm not in favor of that. I don't know why. Those two storylines can just stay separate. Fine.
I did like Ahsoka with Grogu, though.
I did. I like Grogu with Luke. But Ahsoka and Luke is...
Then, of course, we're going to have to find out, like, what happened. Like,
Ezra and Luke.
People are like, oh, what if, like, Ben killed Grogu, and then I have to explain the entire plot of Kylo Ren to them.
Yeah. He didn't, I mean, no. I hope Grogu wasn't involved in that,
I hope
like,
Grogu
he could be.
There, and I'm just like, he probably just, like, I don't know, he was doing something else at that point.
Unless he was there and he survived, and then he witnessed, like, 2 full slaughters of his temples. In which case, Grogu's definitely going to the dark side.
Yeah, Grogu has experienced a lot of trauma.
Yeah.
A lot. Like, a lot.
I feel like Yoda's Force Ghost should go take him underhand. Like, hey. Although, I guess Yoda's not. He has this, I don't know. He like, later on, he's pretty charming. I liked him in Clone Wars.
I love Yoda. I don't really like Yoda in Clone Wars. I love Yoda in Empire Strikes Back and Return of the Jedi and Last Jedi. Like, because, again, I love, like, old, like, weirdo Yoda.
Yes. And I feel like, from a certain point of view, it does enhance that, like, transition, too. Because he's kind of fooling in a way that's not super clear when you first see the original trilogy. Like, what?
Yeah.
So, yes. Speaking of, we're going to skip ahead a little bit. Actually, we shouldn't because we have to talk about the raiding party. We will not skip ahead. But there wasn't, like, a natural segue to talk about how much that interaction with the Yoda's Force Ghost is still so enjoyable in The Last Jedi. I love it. I tell myself Yoda's wisdom all the time. Which, you know what? I'm just going to find that page. We should reiterate again that failure is important. Heeded my words, not did you, Yoda said. Pass on what you have learned. Wisdom, yes, but folly also. Strength and mastery, but weakness and failure, yes. Failure most of all. The greatest teacher of failure is. Love it. Anyways.
I was, like, so shocked to see Yoda the first time I saw The Last Jedi. And yes. Then it was just, like, so perfect, their interaction.
Okay. And he just, like, when he's calling Luke out and saying, like, Skywalker missed you, have I? It's so good. So, yeah, going back, that scene is pretty similar between the movie and the film. Or, sorry. The movie and the novel. But there are certain parts of the novel that, like, really change things for me. And one of them was when Rey's practicing with her staff and then she switches to the lightsaber. In the film, you see Luke, like, kind of standing away, like, standing up on the outcrop. And he's watching her, but she's not aware of it. And then she gets more and more into it, and then she destroys the outcropping, causing destruction. And he turns away, and, like, the impression you get is, like, Luke's disgusted. And in the novel, this was actually Luke causing that. So he's just like, all of a sudden just says impressive. And the sound of his voice jerked her out of her trance. This is Ray. Turning to look at him, she stumbled slightly, her slash continuing, so it intersected with rock instead of just empty air. And then the caretakers are pissed, obviously. And I like that better, because in the movie, it did seem like he was just being very judgy. It also makes more sense, right? Like, Ray's practicing, but she's pretty in control. And, like, if Luke just showed up and said impressive behind her, that would be enough to, like, cause that.
Yeah, I mean, getting
caught up in things.
In the movie, I guess I just took it as, like, she was so intent on what she was doing and so focused that, like, she didn't realize.
Mm-hmm. Also, just, like, Luke in this is just kind of, he's weird. I appreciate that. And we're going to talk about
this. I mean, he's certainly weird in the movie as well, which I also love, but.
Yeah. Weirder.
Some people did not appreciate
him. I feel like Luke is very, I can see the natural trajectory from the original trilogy to The Last Jedi for Luke. Like, I don't understand why people are like, no, Luke would never be like that. I'm like, Luke was so whiny every single time.
Yeah, and he does get progressively better. Like, he's not very whiny in Return of the Jedi, but yeah, I also find his character to be consistent. Like, I can definitely imagine him progressing into who he is in The Last Jedi.
I mean, maybe that's just, like, a testament to Mark Hamill's acting. Because he does make it very easy to go from, like, point A to point B as Mark Hamill. And speaking of, there was a scene where, maybe we should read this. No, we shouldn't. Because it's just weird. It's weird. Luke makes, like, he makes a comment about, like, they see some ships in the distance. And Ray's like, what are these ships? And Luke's like, oh, those are our neighboring tribes coming to, like, raid and plunder the caretakers. They do it every month. And Ray gets very protective and defensive of the caretakers. And she, like, rushes off. And it turns out, I don't know why Luke said that.
So basically,
that, like,
he tells her that, like, this happens routinely, but you, like, she can't interfere because if she does,
it's not the Jedi way.
Yeah, it's not the Jedi way, and it'll just, like, exacerbate the situation and make it worse. And she's just like, no, like, we can't let this happen. And then it turns out that he just, like, completely made this up. And she, like, rushes over to go see what's going on, and the caretakers are, like, having a huge party, essentially.
And then she, like, awkwardly waves her lightsaber in the air. I loved. And then Luke eventually comes down and joins her, and, like, there's this long pause, and finally she's just, like, raid and plunder. And Luke is just like, yeah, I didn't think you were gonna run so fast. And, like, it's so easy to imagine Mark Hamill saying this, but, like, it is just a little bit like the, I'm not entirely sure what his what his end game was with that. And then they dance, which is just weird. It's
very weird.
Very weird.
Like, it's not that I take it as being creepy. It's just weird.
Yeah, it's, like, just enough out of character that's kind of, like, disconcerting. Yeah. If this was a deleted scene, I'm glad they deleted it. Would have made the pacing odd, too, so. And then the novel also makes it much more explicit that, like, Luke is returning to the Force and, like, opening himself up again.
Yeah, so there is a specific, actually, it's, like, quite long, so I'm not going to read all of it, but the novel does make it very clear that he intentionally chooses to connect to the Force again.
Mm-hmm.
So he goes and sits on the ledge outside of the temple where he was helping Rey to understand the Force, and then he basically, like, gives himself the same advice that he was giving Rey. And then the wind filled his ears, the island's constant companion. It was a whisper now, the low conversation of autumn breezes, instead of the whine of winter or the howl of a summer storm. He could hear the night birds calling as they rode high above him, and the metronome calls of insects from the grasses. Behind him, in the ancient temple, the still surface of the water in the ancient font began to ripple and dance. Luke could hear more now, far more. He heard the static of pebbles and sand being washed back and forth beneath the waves. He listened to the bump of the worms pushing blindly through the dirt, building their tunnels and revitalizing the soil. He heard the muttering of the season's last porglets as they turned inside their eggs beneath the heartbeats of their mothers. He heard the world flooding back into his senses.
It's a good passage.
And it actually, like, goes on more than that and talks about how he experiences the Force again and the different aspects of the Force, the living Force, ceaseless and ever-renewing. But the Jedi had spoken of another aspect, the cosmic Force. It had an awareness and a purpose and a will that had been silent, dormant after the demise of the Sith, only to wake once again during Luke's exile, a will that Luke finally allowed himself to acknowledge once again.
Yeah.
And then it also mentions that that's what allows Leia to feel his presence too.
Yep. Which is what we see in the movie. It's kind of abbreviated. Speaking of, it also makes it very clear that one of the things that like isn't clear in the movie is Luke is force projecting himself, but he interacts with Leia and like kisses her lips and she smiles, and it's not clear like kisses her forehead. Wrong movie. But Jason Fry takes that and like clarifies she knows he's not real. And so he does that interaction where he kisses her forehead, not her lips.
Not this time.
Not this time. And he writes, when they touched, when they touched, she immediately understood. A slight smile played at the corners of her mouth, and her eyes shone with the secret the two of them now shared. Kissing siblings. So I like that a lot. That kind of like cleared things up. I was like, okay, she knew. Very good.
Yeah, I mean, I've seen that movie many times, and I don't think I necessarily inferred that.
No. No.
I mean, that totally makes sense, but I know when I saw that movie the first time, like, I had no idea. And then, like, later on, if you watch it again, you notice things. Like, he winks at C-3PO when he's walking out, but yeah, I just, it didn't even occur to me that she understood that he wasn't actually there.
Yeah. Yes. Exactly. And like, you know, you see his foot, like it's a focus on his footwork and he doesn't scrape the top of the salt and stuff like that. Which I love. Like,
totally did not register for me whatsoever.
Yeah. The first time? No, not at all. And so I like that a lot. Like it kind of makes that scene more enjoyable when you're like looking out for those things. And again, kudos to Rian Johnson for kind of that subtlety. So anything else for Luke? Otherwise, I'm going to proceed to Rey. So with Rey, oddly enough, despite like both of us happening upon Rey-themed cocktails, I don't feel like I gained too much insight into her character with the novelization. And I'm going to make the case that like Jason Fry wasn't very interested in exploring the dynamic, the romantic dynamic between Rey and Ben. So I kind of like was picking this up subtly, like those scenes seemed kind of flat to me, but I do feel like it's very obvious with the cowl scene, because normally like when you're reading a book and there's romantic tension between the characters, like the author doesn't make it explicit necessarily, but there's enough like hidden hints that like you're like, oh, I bet they're into each other, and this is like something I love to do. With the cowl scene, it's just kind of flat. So it goes, why did you hate your father? She demanded, then stopped. Oh, Kylo was stripped to the waist in his chambers. The angry scars she'd given him in their duel snaked down his face and neck and across his collarbone. Like, that's not like, oh, I'm into you. It's just like, wow, there's some scars. And her eyebrows rose, but Kylo was unruffled by the sight of her. He's not like into, like, it's just not clear that he's into her. And seemingly undisturbed by her question, because he was a weak-minded fool, she said. Ray forced herself to look into his eyes, those angry, haunted, needy eyes. Like, none of this is saying, like, you know, those deep, dark, haunted, gorgeous eyes or anything like that. It's like, I don't know, it just came across as kind of detached, and there's no romantic tension. There's no romantic tension.
So this is why I thought it was interesting that you were like, Jason Fry definitely is not interested in Raylo. It's like, definitely not. Like, putting anything more into the novel than what is in the movie. Because we don't really get a lot of this novel from Kylo's perspective.
No.
Like, I feel like the few times we do, like, the one that comes in my... in mind. The one that comes to mind is when he is approaching the resistance ship in his TIE fighter and knows that Leia is there and can't bring himself to shoot at her, basically. But then I feel like all the other scenes with him, for the most part, are from someone else's perspective. So we don't get a lot of, like, what's going on in his head. So, for that reason, it's hard to tell what he's thinking about Rey, other than what we see already in the movie.
Yeah. But there's, like, a part, I'm trying to find that, where, like, he, like, says her name, and, like, Jason Fry describes it as, like, with disgust. And, like, that
That's, like, a dialogue that's not in the movie. When he is talking to Luke and he's like, you chose Rey over me or something like that.
Yeah. And I'm just like, I don't feel like Kylo would ever say her name with disgust because that's not how he feels towards Rey. Yeah, Rey, Kylo said, speaking her name like it was poison. Your chosen one, chosen over me. Like,
well, he was also probably like pissed off at Rey at this point.
Yeah. But at the same time, like, I don't know, it was just, like, enough, like, subtle hints or, like, lack thereof to kind of make me feel like Jason Fry was not particularly interested in it. Like, he may have been neutral about it, but it wasn't,
well,
like,
see,
he's
what
a Raylo
I think
fan.
Is interesting is that I feel like some of, like, what is in this novel that is from Rey's perspective in scenes with Kylo is interesting and is not something that we necessarily get from seeing the movie. Like, I don't know, I have quotes. So I have talked before about how I feel like it's obvious that Kylo is into Rey. Like, even in The Force Awakens, he's just so fascinated by her and it's really, like, not concealed at all. And I feel like that was especially the case in Rise of Skywalker. But Rey is much more interior about it, I think. Like, she, I think, first of all, especially after the events of the end of The Last Jedi, like, doesn't want to show her emotions to him.
Yeah.
But I feel like there are parts of this novelization where her emotions are described more than we would necessarily see them in the movie.
Oh, and really?
Again, it's not explicit. Like, it's not like her thoughts are like, oh my god, I think he's so attractive. Or even like, I think he's so attractive and I don't know what's wrong with me. It's like, she doesn't want to feel that way.
Mm.
Maybe I'm just like reading way too much into this. Or maybe this is, like, what I want to interpret it as, but I'll read some quotes.
Okay.
So, I had a passage bookmarked in the scene where they're in the elevator going to see Snoke.
Yeah.
And it's the part where she's telling him, like, when we touched, I saw your future. I know that you will turn. And he's like, no, I know that you'll turn. And then it says, Rey stared at him, but there was no lie in Kylo's eyes, and a terrifying realization bloomed in her mind. Kylo's turning emotions weren't just about himself. They were also about her.
interesting. Yeah, to me that was kind of like a sterile way of saying that, like, he expected her to turn versus, like, he was into her.
There is a passage, like, a few pages before that, too, where, like, it's talking about how she can tell that he's conflicted and he, like, has all of these emotions stirring. And then I also wanted to talk about the part after they've fought all of Snoke's guards. Let me find that part.
Yeah, and to me, like, you know, when you're watching the film, you're seeing them moving in, like, perfect harmony, you're seeing the teamwork, and it was, like, I don't know, more detached.
So, yeah, this is, like, a similar sentiment, I feel. So, this is, you know, when he's saying, it's time to let the old things die. Mm-hmm. Rey, I want you to join me. Snoke, Skywalker, the Sith, the Jedi, the Rebels, let it all die. We can rule together and bring a new order to the galaxy. She stared at him in disbelief and horror. Don't do this, Ben, Rey said quietly. Please don't go this way. Kylo stepped over Snoke's corpse, just casually.
Yeah.
You're holding on, he said. Let go. He advanced on Rey, the ignited lightsaber held loosely in one hand, but there was no threat in his approach. Somehow, suddenly, that scared her even more.
Yeah, but then he, like, he's talking about, like, her parents, and Rey tried to find the strength to deny him, to shove him away, but he was right. She didn't know the truth, and it was the same as her greatest fear, the one that had haunted her for so long. Like, it seems like, I don't know, like, the timing of that makes it seem like she's more concerned about, like, what he's gonna tell her versus how she feels about him.
I guess the way I see it is, like, she's realizing that he has this interest in her, and she doesn't know what to do with it. Like, it scares her, but she's also not just like, oh, I'm, like, so disgusted by this. Like, she doesn't necessarily reject it. She just says that it scares her.
Yeah. And I feel like in the film, it's more like there's a reciprocal interest there. Like, she's conflicted because she does, like, I don't know, she has this connection to him and she doesn't want to let that go. And I don't feel like that. I guess I'm looking for more, like, support of that versus just, like, these kind of absence of disgust.
Well, another thing is, too, the novel does make it much more explicit that she chooses to seek Kylo out after she goes into the cave. Right. And there's a line that's, like, she knew, like, who she needed to talk to.
Answers. Yeah.
Yeah.
But again, like, it's a lot about her parents with that. And I feel like, yes, there is an aspect of that. But I don't know, like, I feel like she wants more than answers.
It's, like, I totally understand wanting more from it because I also do. We've established we are Reylos. And I would love to have more content and, like, just have more. Like, I am not satisfied with what we have. But right. At the same time, this movie was not intended, I don't think, to be, like, super explicit in it.
No. But this is, like, I mean, there's enough where, like, you know, when you compare it to, like, Finn and Rose, for instance, where you could have gone either way a little bit. Like, Rose's kiss could have been a kiss of gratitude if you had wanted it to be. Like, he makes that very explicit in a way that he does not do for Rey and Kylo, which I thought was a notable distinction.
I guess I can totally see from my perspective, like, why he would not be heavy-handed with it, because the first time I saw The Last Jedi, I just, like, didn't get it. And then I saw it for a second time, and I was like, wait, what is happening?
Yes! And that's my thing. It's just, like, I feel like there's more chemistry and more connection between Kylo and Rey than there is between Finn and Rose. And yet Jason Fry, like, goes out of his way to make that connection very clear and downplay the other connection. or at least like talk about it in a way that's not very compelling. Like there, you could read into it, but like it's not.
I guess I'm like almost putting this into like the gothic romance framework, which I'm not gonna get into it. Like I'm certainly not an expert on literature. I only have my own experiences with it, and like I did not study it formally or anything. And if you want to get into Kylo Ren as a Byronic hero and
yes,
how you can put this into a gothic romance framework, like definitely seek that out because it is very interesting. But like I guess that's kind of almost how I'm approaching it, is like this idea that like she feels this connection to Kylo and she doesn't fully understand it and it scares her, but that doesn't mean that she doesn't want it.
Yeah, I would agree, but when I think about like how gothic romances are written and like the amount of tension you feel across the page, even when there's like not very much going on, that feels notably absent to me in this novel. Like when I compare like Jane Eyre, for instance, and like her inner dialogue and how like she's also very refined and monitoring her emotions a lot, but it is still very clear that she is like very interested in the hero. Muted
Mr. Rochester
that kind of muted like tension is missing in this for me. Like there's
not
a
missing
lot
from the movie though.
No, definitely not missing from the movie. No, but from the novel it really doesn't come across on the page, and that's kind of like what I would have been looking for. Like you could have written it in a way that like is very muted and does convey that kind of like, oh, I'm not sure, but I'm really into it, but I'm scared sort of thing. And that's not, I don't know if that's really present. There are a lot of like moments where it's ambiguous, but it's not that kind of like simmering. It's not simmering. It's like stagnant. Apparently I'm using water as a metaphor. This pool is not moving.
It's not, I mean, bubbling. Water is used as a metaphor in the movie.
There we go. So yeah, I was underwhelmed.
All right. I don't think I have anything to say on that.
But you do, because you have this line that says, like, what was Chewie thinking when Rey?
Oh, yeah. So this is something that was, like, just brought into stark relief by the novel, where they're talking about how Rey is, like, getting the escape pod ready to send herself to Kylo. Yeah. And, like, Chewie is helping her. And I'm just like, what must his thoughts be in this moment? Like,
that's a great question.
He has all this history with Han and with Ben, and she's just like, yeah, Chewie, I think I'm just going to put myself in this escape pod and just, you know, bring myself onto Kylo Ren's ship. Like, and he's just like, all right.
He's just over it. Go ahead. The Wookiee has reached his point. He's just like, okay.
Like, I already had to see what was done to the Falcon. Like, I just can't take anymore, so like do what you want.
Yeah. I'm not gonna watch you die, essentially.
And then there is also a section where we're like hearing Rey's thoughts when she's in the escape pod and she's on the ship at that point, and she's talking about how she can sense the anxiety from the stormtroopers who are just like, what is going on?
See, this ties in perfectly with from a certain point of view, because I am feeling very, very strongly for those stormtroopers. Like, they just were selected for duty and they're like, shit, what the hell is this? Like, there's gonna be a lot of swearing in this one.
Yeah. She's just like, I can tell that they're just like, nobody told me that like this was gonna happen. I don't know how to respond to this.
You know,
and
what,
if I respond incorrectly, then Kylo Ren's gonna be angry.
Yeah, I was like, at least they have helmets, no one can see their face. But you know what, Kylo Ren kind of negates that benefit.
Yeah.
Those are great points. I also, like, it's weird because I could have, like, the novel does make that more explicit, and I totally still just was just like, oh, whatever. But yes. Poor Chewie. Poor Chewie. Anyways, Finn is next up for me. My first line is lots of guilt for Finn. Lots of guilt for Finn in this one. And I did like the way that the novel portrayed him as being kind of innocent and naive. I thought that was, like, really charming. It's just me, isn't it?
I felt, I don't know, I wouldn't say that this novel enhanced my experience of Finn and Rose.
Okay, so I'm still not in favor of their romance, but I liked Finn and, like, their dynamic and their banter.
I felt, I don't know, I know a lot of people just, like, abjectly hate the scene on Canto Bight. I don't hate it, but no. I do feel like it goes on for a long time, and in this novel it goes on for even longer.
It does. But, like, it has such great dialogue. Like, Jason Fry is good at writing dialogue. And I liked his insights into Rose, as we'll talk about. But, like, Finn is pretty cute in this to me.
I still feel very neutral about him.
I'm going to only highlight one because I had several quotes, but, like, only one is sufficient. And so there's this part that, like, Finn is saying, talking about, like, the yacht that they stole, or is it a yacht? Whatever the ship is. He's like, 4 parsecs to go. This thing cooks. He must do all right as a thief if he owns a ship like this. I'm laughing even now. Rose looked at him pityingly. I can't say that word. Pityingly? Say that one more time, slowly. I'm saying he must be a good thief if, oh, right, he stole it. I loved it. I just thought that was, like, you know, he hasn't experienced much of the world as a stormtrooper, and, like, here he is out in the world, kind of, like, just enjoying it. Joie de vivre. And then there are some additional insights. So he, like, coaches DJ and Rose about how to pretend to be officers, and the additional scene that we had mentioned at the beginning about the First Order stormtrooper recognizing Finn was surprisingly stressful for me. Like, I knew that they obviously weren't going to be caught, but it felt like they were. So I don't know if you felt the same way, Europa.
Yeah, I really liked that scene.
Yeah.
I thought it just provided some more context to Finn and, like, what he could have become.
Yes.
And I liked kind of the tension that there was, where Rose is witnessing this happening and realizing that he was an anomaly, and, like, kind of wondering why he was, like, what made him different, and realizing how easily he could have just stayed within that system.
Yeah. I wish they had, like, I mean, maybe this will be something that they, like, get back to later, but, like, it would have been nice to have, like, additional context there. Because, like, we do learn that, like, there are other stormtroopers who have turned, but, like, a lot of time is spent, like, portraying Finn as kind of, like, this, like, unusual, yeah, failure.
So maybe this is a good time to bring up something that you didn't necessarily flag, but I thought was very interesting. This is getting into Hux, but there is a passage that talks about the stormtrooper program.
Yeah.
In comparison to the Jedi. And I just think it's so interesting and illuminating. It's basically Hux, like, thinking about the Jedi when he's watching Kylo try and destroy Luke.
Yeah.
So he's talking about his father. His father, Brendel, had told him how the Jedi had maintained their power by seizing Force-sensitive infants and training them as warriors. The Jedi had agreed to lend the Republic's to lead the Republic's clone armies, but turned on Chancellor Palpatine and tried to seize control of the Senate. The clones, ironically another order of soldiers trained from infancy, had prevented this betrayal, turning their guns on their former generals. The Jedi had deserved their fate, Brendel said, but there was much to learn from their methods, as there was from the training regiments of the Republic's clones. The Elder Hux had forged elements of both orders to create an army of soldiers trained as soon as they left the cradle, an army that had originated under the Empire but achieved its full glory under the First Order and the younger Hux. So, in a sense, the First Order stormtroopers were the Jedi's legacy.
Hux is crazy.
Hux is, like, especially crazy in this novelization.
Yep.
But, I mean, I appreciate it whenever the flaws of the Jedi are pointed out, because they had many, and I feel like, you know, taking children as infants and just kind of forcing them into this life was definitely one of them. And, like,
that's true.
This just illustrates, like, now it's something that the First Order was like, yeah, that's the ideal way to just indoctrinate people and ensure that they're loyal and they do as we say.
Yeah. And also, like, it was interesting that he didn't go into more detail, because, like, in the movie, it's implied that there's, like, some sort of, like, programming, almost like, I'm assuming, brainwashing, and that's kind of omitted from that. But I would be, it'd be interesting to learn more about their methods.
So, just to finish up with Hux, because I feel like we didn't have too much on him, but yeah, like, I feel like this movie, the movie kind of softened Hux a little bit, because obviously in The Force Awakens, like, he looks insane when he's standing in front of all the troops and screaming about Starkiller Base and, like, scary. But then there's that whole, like, comical scene at the beginning of The Last Jedi, and he has, like, some funny...
Can you hear me?
Yeah. He has, like, some funny dialogue with Kylo. So, I feel like you sort of get to not feel as, like, hostile towards Hux necessarily, even though, obviously, like, he is still evil. And then, of course, in Rise of Skywalker, like, I don't even know what happened with that. I don't necessarily want to get into it. But, like, I feel like the novelization, because like you kind of get into his head, like he's just like unhinged.
Yeah. I have like the section under the First Order, like it kind of ruined Hux for me because I have a soft spot for Domhnall Gleeson. And
he seems like a very delightful person, and
he's so cute.
He's so good in other things. He's good as Hux too. It's just, it's not his fault.
Yeah, I mean, like, he makes it better, and then the novelization just like peels that away, and it's just like the man's a fanatic and obsessed. And like when Kennedy and the other officer are talking or thinking about him, like, they're very acutely aware that he's like a revolutionary who is rabid. And I
also there's a line which I'm sure I pointed out to you in the Rise of Skywalker novelization where Hux is just going off about Kylo's hair. Stupid hair. Like, it's so good.
See, and that's charming. I love that. And, like, that makes it better for me. But, like, yeah, in this novelization, it's hard to read his passages. Which maybe, I mean, maybe this is a good transition to Rose, because that scene where she, like, bites his hand, I'm like, you do not know where that hand has been. Like, And, like, he's like, refers to her as vermin. And, like, he's definitely, like, there are strong, strong, strong overtones of autocracy and Nazis. And, like, it's hard to deal with his scenes.
Well, I mean, look at The Force Awakens.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Which, I mean, like, maybe that's a good thing, right? Like, we probably shouldn't sympathize with Hux or, like Hux as much as we do. Because like, I do, like, I like Hux. Yeah, I know. Damn you for being so cute. Yeah, so Rose bites Hux, and he...
I think his name is actually Donald. I think I just can't pronounce his name.
I can't see it.
Which is terrible, because I don't... I say that, but, like, just because I am of Irish heritage doesn't mean that I, like, can speak Gaelic, so... Gaelic seems extremely difficult.
Yes. And I think, as we've learned from this entire podcast, it's just, like, I have difficulty pronouncing even, like... All names. Sorry. I, like, second guess myself and then, like, mispronounce them in, like, ways that are weird for, like,
apologies.
From the Midwest. Apologies. We're so sorry.
I'm so sorry. Donald Gleason.
Yeah.
If that is even the correct pronunciation.
Anyways. Rose, we are introduced to her and Paige, and there's a lot of, like, backstory about their sisterhood, which also caused me pangs of sadness. There's a lot of more context into how she feels about Finn. I am not there for their romance in any respect. Like, even with the additional information, I hate it.
I am completely neutral towards their romance, but, like...
There's no romance!
It's just... You point out that she, like, has inner dialogue about how Finn is, like, constantly talking about Rey and obsessed with finding Rey and making sure Rey is okay. And she's just like, what is the deal with this? And, like, even says to him, like, wow, like, you really are obsessed with her. And she, like, clearly thinks that he's in love with her. But, like, that is never resolved. Like, again, in Rise of Skywalker, there's that whole scene where he's like, Rey, I need to tell you something.
Yes!
And he's like, what is it? And then he's just like, nothing, and then never tells her. And literally everyone assumed that he was gonna tell her that, like, he was into her. And then JJ Abrams came out and was like, oh yeah, he was gonna say he's force sensitive. So, like, I still don't know what's going on. Honestly,
I feel like this is, like, a weak point in the sequel trilogy. It's just, like, there's a lot of dancing around, and I don't know if it's just because, like, there were different directors, but it is, like, very clear that Finn has a thing for Rey, and then they just, like, back off of it. There's just a lot of, like, you know, if you just have a simple conversation, you can determine if someone else is, like, reciprocates your feelings. I know that's scary, and I know it's a lot easier to just have these, like, unspecified crushes, but at the same time, like, you're going through life and death situations. The time is now, people. Like,
and then he also has no idea of anything that has transpired between Rey and Kylo, because she never tells him. And he's just like, oh, what's going on? Like, are you okay? And she's just like, oh, you, like, no, I can't tell you. So, like, it's very frustrating.
It is. I'm just like, everyone in Star Wars needs some therapy. Like, you need to articulate your feelings. Like, if you're feeling something, that is fine, but you need to, like, make your peace with it. I'm saying this as if I've made my peace with it, and that's not true, but, like, you know, I'm trying. And, like, yeah. I may be ranting about this way too much, but, like, at least Rose is just like, dude, you have something for Rey. And she's like, Rey's gonna change. And he's like, no, she's not. And, like, sure enough, she does. And then, like, it's only addressed at the end of the book. And he's like, oh, she did change, but she's still Rey. And I'm just like, way to cop out.
And then he spends the whole next movie just being like, Rey!
Rey! Kudos to Jason Fry for, like, really calling it out with Rose and being like, this crush is weird, and then, like, contextualizing it in a very charming way.
I did enjoy
that. I love this passage.
It made a lot of sense.
Yeah. It, like, makes everything better. She's like, oh, right. And so there's this part where, like, Rose is like, he has this bizarre crush on a friend of his. It is. It's so funny that she, like, immediately recognizes they're totally friends.
Yeah, she's just like, what is the deal?
I know. Whoever this Rey was, she had to be quite something to make you desert people you had fought alongside and a cause you had come to believe in. But then she remembered Finn had grown up in a First Order training hall, one of those luckless orphans who got numbers instead of names. Maybe that was why he'd fallen so hard for his friend. The number of people who'd been nice to him must be depressingly small. Like, and this is why I love Rose. Like, thank you, Jason Fry, for making her continue to be awesome. And I also really enjoyed the scene where, like, she gets to ride on a Fathier. I can't say that word either. Fathier?
Fathier?
Fathier? I don't know. But the Fathiers have a matriarchal society, which is really cool. And I continue to hate the scene where she flies into Finn to save him, does that little speech thing, which I've come, that's okay. But then when she calls him dummy, I still hate that. I just hate it.
I agree. That just also irks me as well. Like, all I just don't. Time. Just the word dummy.
Yes! Exactly.
Sorry, like, Rian Johnson.
I hate it.
I don't like your word choice here.
It feels overly judgmental and also kind of just like derogatory. Yeah. Yes.
As we've established, though, I do really like Rose, and I do like what Jason Fry did with her character and enjoyed like spending more time with her in this novel.
Yeah, exactly.
It did kill me, though, emotionally every time she was like thinking about her sister.
Oh my god.
The part where she was riding the Fathier, she was just like, she calls her Pei-Pei.
She's
just like, Pei-Pei, you would have loved this. And I'm just like, no.
Oh my gosh, it's so good. Like, he gets sisterhood. I appreciate that. So sad. And now we're gonna have to transition to Poe, if she's just like, bleh. All right. So we're going to talk about Poe. I had been unaware of Happy Beeps, but it... Happy Beeps, but it... Okay. I was unaware of Happy Beeps, buddy, which apparently is very difficult for me to say, as a thing. Again, there was the Poe essay in Into a Larger World that made me more aware of it, because the author of that, Amanda M., mentioned having that as a tattoo. And I'm like, oh, wow, that is charming.
Yeah, I actually really like that.
Yeah. And as we talked about a little bit, the novel does a better job of humanizing him, but he still makes really bad decisions.
Yeah. I guess it does kind of improve how I view him, because he seems like slightly less arrogant.
Does he though?
Like, I don't know. Like, I guess it's like easier to see that, you know, he did have respect for Leia. Like,
yes,
he did have some sense of recognizing that he like made mistakes, but not enough in my opinion.
Nope. It also doesn't help that like he is also a character that, like, is viewed often through the perspective of other characters. And it is consistently, like, Leia, Maz. The one chapter Maz is in, she's just, like, too impatient. Like, he's not going to make it. And, like, everyone describes him as impatient, proud, arrogant, needs to be taken down a peg. And just, like, makes his decisions that much harder to deal with, because everyone around him can recognize he is making rash choices and thinks he knows too much.
Like, think about what that would be like as Leia or as Holdo. Like,
this punk kid. Punk kid. Like, yeah, he's what, 35, and he's just like, I'm a hotshot pilot, I know how to deal with things, like, I should have been named blah blah blah. And it's just like, dude.
Yeah, like when they're announcing someone's gonna have to take Leia's place, he's like, oh, obviously it's gonna be me.
Yeah, and then he doesn't know,
like,
what it has to be.
Like, literally in his head is like, yeah, I mean, I'm just a pilot, but like, why couldn't I be promoted to be in charge? Like,
yeah, there's man. there's no cognizance, yeah, on his part of like other skills than just being like rash and decisive. And it's just like, yeah, there are other skills. and also, like, it just makes it that much harder, because like, you're, so they set him up as everyone has thoughts on him, And then you're supposed to rely on his perspective to, like, in regards to Holdo a little bit. And it doesn't make sense, right? Like, you've already established that he's an unreliable narrator. And then for him to just be like, she's a traitor, she's not giving hope. I'm just like, yeah, I'm already not trusting you, though. Like, why would I listen to anything you say about Holdo? So that was harder in regards to the novel for me. Because, like, I don't trust him. I'm not going to put my faith in a rash pilot and be like, oh, yeah, you know, she is a traitor. I believe you, Poe. Also, I mean, maybe if we hadn't written an entire essay about Holdo. And then another beef I have with this is just like, and this is something that like really came through in The Rise of Skywalker, and the novelization also just doesn't do a good job of handling it here, is there's no real reckoning for Poe. Like, he went behind the back of his superior officer, encouraged a plan that resulted in failure, but that failure led to the death of transports because the First Order found out about their ploy because he told it to Rose and Finn. And DJ was there and happened to overhear. Like, that was on Poe. And there's no point in any of this where he's like, oh, I screwed up. That's me. Like, the most we get is, like, him whining about the fact that Holdo didn't tell him anything and Leia comforting him. And I'm like, that is not okay. Like, yeah.
Yeah, you have the quotes here where it says, why didn't she tell me? He asked Leia plaintively.
Yeah.
And she's like, the fewer who knew, the better. Protecting the light was more important to her than looking like a hero. And then it's just like contemplating that Poe turned to look back at the window. Like,
yeah, exactly. There's no like contemplating. I had added like little brackets that he had been an utter jerk, or like even before the transport started being destroyed, that like he had screwed things up. Like, and, like, there's another scene, like, from his perspective, and it's just, like, they were moving too slowly, the transports. There were too many transports. The First Order knew about their ploy, and there's no recognition on Poe's part that the reason they knew was because of him. And then they arrive on Crait, and Poe's first reaction is to be like, oh, where's my droid? And so he's, like, interacting with BB-8. He's like, buddy! Blah, 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 blah.
I can't help but be charmed by that scene, though, honestly, because it's just like...
BB-8 is amazing.
BB-8 is so cute, and again, it's like a dog, and he's, like, rubbing BB-8's belly. It's so cute.
Yeah, but it'd be, like, me, like, running up towards my dog and being, like, after I had gotten, like, thousands and or hundreds of people killed, and been like, oh, hey, buddy! Like, how's it going? I've missed you! Oh, hello! And then, like, Finn and Rose are left to deal with the emotional toll, and they're like, where is everybody? Is this all that's left? And Poe's just like, hey, my dog's here.
Yeah. Short attention span.
Maybe we should.
I mean, dogs are very comforting.
That's true.
Dogs are very comforting.
But I expected more of, like, awareness, penance, on your knees. Like, yeah.
And he also has one of my least favorite lines in this scene where he's like, I hope this big-ass door keeps them out.
Oh, God. I feel for everyone who has to deal with him. And then it does piss me off that Holdo's just like, I like him. I'm like, what? Why? Like, what could he possibly have done to give you that, like, impression? He's a complete and utter jerk to you. I like him,
even though I'm going to die shortly, in part because of his actions.
Yeah, exactly. Because he, like, consistently thinks that he knows best just because, like, he thinks he does. Like, screw you, man. That really still bothers me.
Yeah, I mean, I agree. I know I shouldn't feel this way, but it also kind of, like, pisses me off a little when they're like trying to figure out how to get out, like, the other side, and he's like, oh, let's do this and this, and like they all like look at Leia and she's like, why are you looking at me? Follow him. And I'm just like, why? No, why? Don't trust him anymore.
Yeah, exactly. I'm like, way to reward him after he got all those transports killed, after he like tried to commit mutiny and like Holdo died. let's give him authority and control and command. Like, screw that. I would literally give command to anyone else. You have conics. You have, I'm just like angrily gesturing. you have General Darcy, like anyone. Let's trust the rash pilot who like killed a bunch of people. All right. Making my own dog nervous. All right. But for as frustrating as Poe is, even in the novelization, BB-8 is like 10 times better. BB-8's already amazing, and they just like took that and added another level to me. So there's a scene where he's interfacing with the black one, which is the X-Wing, that is featured at the beginning when Poe's like doing the run on the Fulminatrix. I apparently just really enjoy the black one, like trying to just be like very, they describe it as like a vainglorious prickly machine, and so it tries to like say no, we didn't complete the pre-flight checklist, this isn't okay, and it's just like, I have all these things that like need to be done, maintenance alerts, and BB-8's like, seriously, we're like in space, like we need to go. And Black One's just like, no. And so he has to like kind of like hijack that, which makes so much makes so much more sense, provides so much more context to that entire scene, and it's just like fantastic. Kudos to Jason Fry for that. I also thought it was hilarious where the Black One, like when they get back, it starts asking all these questions, but like, was it the fastest flight from an X-Wing ever? Was it the And BB-8's like, sure, whatever.
Yeah, yeah, definitely.
Whatever you say. I also thought it was interesting that like BB-8 was deliberately acting as a slot machine on Cantobite, because in the film it's not very clear. Like, you don't know if this other character is just like forcibly holding him there, but no, BBA is just like deliberately, I mean, like, I am a slot machine, whatever. And I also enjoyed his internal musings on Cantobite, where he's talking about like improvisation and how he's like developed a knack for it. That was good. And then Rose has some thoughts on BB-8s, which I will read in full because they're amazing. Rose made a mental note. Make that another mental note. Take Poe aside. Should they actually manage to rescue the Resistance fleet without dying in any of the a dozen ways she had decided would be too depressing to catalog? Having already proven amenable to disobeying orders, assuming false identities, and committing simple assault, the pilot's astromech was now developing a taste for larceny. Page 188 for me. That was great. BB-8 is definitely, like, has his own character. And then I also thought it was funny that he was like expecting to be caught when he was posing as a trash can, and like no one came for him. Like, I feel like you should read that one because then my throat's getting dry.
When the stormtroopers burst into the tracking control room, BB-8 had frozen, waiting for someone to wonder why Finn, Rose, and DJ had bothered lugging an overturned trash can along with them. At the very least, once the threat of sabotage had been dealt with, surely some luckless stormtrooper would be ordered to take the bin to maintenance so it could be returned to the position specified by some tediously comprehensive first order document. But nothing happened.
I love it. And I BB-8 spends a lot of time in this novel talking about, like, no one notices a droid. And I never wondered, like, Rose and Finn are captured and, like, they're brought to, like, the execution squad. And then all of a sudden BB-8 shows up in a walker. And I wasn't like, wait, why didn't they capture BB-8? Like, totally didn't think about that. And then Holdo is our final entry for the Resistance. We talked about the allusions to Leia, Princess of Alderaan, which I appreciated. And we've talked at length about how much more complicated this novel makes the interactions between her and Poe. Because there are definitely, like, in addition to the insights we gain from Poe and yet he still makes the same poor decisions. There's also, like, very explicit mentions of, like, how he recognizes that her eyes are shrewd. And, like, C-3PO is just like, Princess Leia trusted her. You should trust her, too. And then he goes and does what he does. And, yeah. Like, Rey, I don't feel like there was a whole lot of more insight, but I did appreciate the, like, references to, like, her and Leia's previous friendship.
Yeah. I still just love the insight that we got into her and Leia, Princess of Alderaan. And
so good.
Having read that and then reading this and going back to her in The Last Jedi was just very rewarding.
Yes. So we're just going to talk briefly about the First Order. There's not really a whole lot there. We already talked about Hux a little bit. And under Hux, there's a whole scene where he's, like, interacting with Snoke, talking about the light speed tracker. It doesn't make sense, right? Like,
yeah, see, this is where, like, my husband has issues with Star Wars,
mm-hmm.
where I think I've mentioned before, like, he had an issue with the Holdo maneuver, because he was like, that doesn't make sense. That just, like, broke physics in the Star Wars universe. And I'm just like, I don't care. Like, I honestly don't spend a lot of time thinking about these things. And mechanics. If I do, it's just gonna, like, be confusing. And I feel like technology in Star Wars is not really meant to be, like, explicitly laid out as to how it works. Like, I don't know. I just don't need that. And to a certain extent, I feel like everyone just needs to, like, accept things at face value.
Yes, I'm with you. But when I accept things at face value, I don't expect the novels to, like, go back and be like, just kidding, there's no light speed tracker. We're just triangulating their position. They're essentially, like, yeah, triangulating their position according to Hux and in this conversation with Snoke. I'm just like, wait, what? So, like, even if they had, like, successfully dismantled whatever, like, nothing would have happened because it's a triangulation system. So why would it follow the rules they're thinking it does? I don't know. We talked about Hux discussing the Jedi and the Stormtroopers. Snoke has some kind of interesting perspectives in the novelization. He talks a lot about Palpatine's contingency plan. And he is, like, creepily into Rey's power. I mean, Snoke's already pretty creepy. He's creepier now. And he probes, like, it's very clear that he's, like, prying into her mind. But there's no, like, oh, hey, your parents were clones. There's none of that. So, Rise of Skywalker continues to be frustrating in that respect.
It also is frustrating that, so I feel like from the movie, it's unclear if Snoke is the one that is bridging Rey and Kylo's minds.
Right.
And I feel like at a certain point, I was like, I don't think that that's the case. Before Rise of Skywalker came out, I was like, I don't think that's the case. I think he's lying.
Yeah, claiming credit.
And then that even is, like, what Rise of Skywalker seems to indicate, because then it's revealed that Rey and Ben are a dyad, and they have this innate connection to one another. So I feel like that is implying that it wasn't Snoke.
Mm-hmm.
But then it is, like, explicitly stated in this novelization that it was him. He has the same dialogue, and then there's also, like, internal dialogue where he's like,
it was a gamble
to bridge mm-hmm. their minds, but, like, it had worked out well for him.
Yeah. I agree. It's not clear. And also, like, it just doesn't, I don't know. Like, in KOTOR, there was often, like, I think in both, there were connections that happened. Like, the main character bonded with someone, like something had happened where like they were connected to each other. It wasn't done to them. It just happened. And so it's just like kind of frustrating that like Snoke claims credit and like talks about it in this novelization when I'm just like, I don't feel like that's like really within the abilities of Snoke. And then we have Kylo Ren, which I feel like I feel similar to Kylo as with Rey. This novelization didn't add a whole much into his whole lot. I don't know why I keep saying whole much. Into his mind, because he doesn't have his own passages all that much, as we've talked about. Like, you know, a lot of the things that happen with him are from the perspective of someone else. Like, in the film, you get the sense he's conflicted. Like, you know, you don't really know which way he's going to go. But, like, in the novel, it's definitely, like, I mean, a lot of it is from Snoke's point of view. So I guess it makes sense that he's coming across so passive. But it was kind of frustrating.
Yeah, it's interesting that that scene is really from Snoke's perspective.
Yeah, I thought so, too. Because Snoke, I mean, like, Snoke isn't... He's interesting, but he's not, like, that compelling of a character.
And he was really never intended to be that compelling of a character.
No. No. Exactly. Like, he's kind of a foil. You know?
He was used to illustrate something with Kylo.
I mean...
Until they decided that that was not what they wanted to do.
Right. And, like, there's just so many questions that are unanswered with him,
I don't even want to get into that.
Yeah. He's like, a blank slate.
I don't understand Snoke. Like, it has never been answered to my satisfaction. Like,
No. Whether
Snoke has autonomy or not. Like, what connection he has to Palpatine in particular. How much he knows versus Palpatine. Like, I just don't know.
And then, I don't know, is there anything else you want to talk about, Kylo? I know you have some notes here, but I think we may have already addressed it.
Yes, we did.
Okay. And then we're going to end on Benicio del Toro. What a place to end, DJ. So, in the novel, I thought it was notable that he doesn't have a stutter, which kind of threw me off. And I know that was, like, something Benicio del Toro added, which is kind of interesting. I don't know how much that, like, added to the character. But it does, like, the novel does provide some explanation as to why he's in the cell. I'm pretty sure this isn't a line that's in The Last Skywalker, where The Last Skywalker. Let me combine The Last Jedi and Rise of Skywalker into The Last Skywalker. And so he's in the cell and they ask him why. He's like, brother, this is the only place in town I can get some sleep without worrying about the cops. And I was like, oh, okay, that's great. I also like the explanation that his name wasn't really DJ.
Yes, I enjoy that because DJ's just, it's like so jarring.
It is. Like, it throws me completely out of Star Wars. I'm like, DJ, what the hell? And so Rose decided to call him that because he has a hat that says don't join. It works. And
Benicio del Toro is too much for me often. Often.
I love Benicio del Toro, but he is too much in this. I'm always. I don't know. I feel like he's kind of wasted in this character.
Yeah, I mean, I was thinking about this because we were reading this, and we've also been rewatching all the Marvel movies, and we haven't gotten to Guardians of the Galaxy yet, but we just watched Thor: The Dark World, and the credits scene is him as the Collector, and I was just like,
yes,
God, Benicio del Toro.
But he's that to me feels like more appropriate than him as DJ, because DJ is just kind of like, I do enjoy the way he says maybe at the end. And I liked when I read the book, like imagining Benicio del Toro saying maybe and then walking off the ship. Does he make it off the ship? We never know. I hope so. Okay. And the last character we're going to discuss is Timari.
Broom Boy.
Oh, he's called Broom Boy. That's so cute. So, as with the film, the novel ends on Temari's perspective. And it makes it a little bit more ambiguous.
Yeah, it definitely does.
Yeah. So, in the movie, obviously he's like looking out to the stars and his broom continues moving, which shows that he's force sensitive. And it's kind of like this like awe-inspiring, like even with all the failures of the Jedi, they're still force sensitive kids who believe in the cause and believe in right and wrong. And in the book, it was as he stared up at the stars, the boy absentmindedly turned the broom in his hands until he held it at his side like a lightsaber. So also on a hopeful note, but slightly different.
I feel like we were trying to end this on a good note, but now I'm just thinking about how this ends and the fact that, as you said, like the Jedi are not around. Like a theme of this movie is learning from the past but not
failure,
bound by it. And like Rey has the Jedi texts and obviously is going to take some aspects of the Jedi, but like, you know, you can be force sensitive and want to see a greater good, but you don't have to necessarily be a Jedi. And it didn't go that way.
I know, like, if we just end it there, this is fantastic. Like, this is actually a very positive message, learning from failure and like moving beyond. And then Rise of Skywalker happens and we're just gonna stop there.
That was one of my concerns about this episode, is that we were gonna do some complaining about Rise of Skywalker, which we definitely have, and we have not really discussed Rise of Skywalker extensively on the pod because we have of thoughts about it. And I mean, I think it's obvious that we were disappointed in Rise of Skywalker, but I don't know. We try not to be overly negative, but we will have to deal with it at some point.
Maybe the name of that episode should be like the negative episode or something, and then like people can skip it, because like it's gonna be really hard for me to like take gems of things I liked.
There are things I like about it.
Yeah, and there's so much I hate. We go full Sith on that,
like,
episode.
Like C-3PO, for example.
Hate?
You don't like C-3PO in Rise of Skywalker?
Okay,
he's so funny.
He's hilarious, and then he dies, and his sacrifice is meaningful, and it's just like, oh my gosh, C-3PO came into his own, and then they bring him back.
Yeah. Especially because I feel like the trailer just, like, emotionally blackmailed me, where I saw the trailer where they show him being like, I'm taking one last look at my friends. And I was like, oh my god. Like, I was just, like, ready to be devastated.
The trailers were fantastic. And that makes it worse.
Yeah.
I mean, you know what? Let's do it. Next season, we're going to talk about it, and then you can bleep out everything I say.
Okay, well, that is it for today's show and for season 2. Our intro and outro music is by Lobo Loco, and our segment break music is by Poddington Bear. You can find us on our website at StarWarsSleepover.com, on Twitter at SWSleepover, and on Instagram at StarWarsSleepover. If you like our podcast, please consider subscribing, rating, and especially leaving us a review on Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen. And we would love feedback from our listeners about any upcoming topics you'd like to see us cover. We will be going on hiatus for a little while, but we will be back in the fall with season 3. In the meantime, thanks for listening.
And may the Force be with you.